Well, in 1842, some time ago, I know, a ship struck an iceberg and more than 30 survivors were crowded into a lifeboat that was intended to hold 7. As a storm came, it became obvious that the lifeboat to survive would have to be lightened. The captain of the ship, who was one of those on the boat, reasoned that the right thing to do in this situation was to force some of the passengers to go overboard. Such an action, he said, was not unjust to those thrown overboard, for they would have died anyway. And if he did nothing, everybody would drown when some could be saved. Some people in the boat opposed the captain. They claimed that if nothing was done and everyone died, at least no one would be responsible for the death. On the other hand, if the captain attempted to save some by drowning others, he would be responsible for killing some. And this would be worse than doing nothing and letting all die. The captain, of course, was in charge. He rejected the arguments of the others. And since the only possibility for rescue was to row for some time in the boat, he decided it was the weakest who should be thrown overboard to leave the strong to row to safety. As it turned out, after several days of rowing, the boat was rescued, some survived, and the captain was then tried in court for his actions. If you were on the jury, how would you decide? This is a true story, but it serves as a good real-life example of what philosophers and ethicists love to talk about in far more hypothetical ways sometimes, the issue of moral dilemmas. In my earlier years at university, I studied philosophy and ethics, and in ethics we would spend quite a lot of time discussing these, what were usually slightly more outlandish hypothetical scenarios. Designed to test the limits of our ethical theory, a moral dilemma is a scenario in which a person has two competing moral demands, but is unable to do both things. There are moral reasons to do each of the actions, but doing both actions is not possible. The hypotheticals of our philosophy classroom were often a bit more ridiculous or far-fetched, but the classic you may have heard before is the trolley problem. Does anyone know the trolley problem? A trolley is running out of control down a track. A trolley meaning like a train car or something in the, you know, olden days. I don't even know what they are. In its path are 5 people who have been tied to the track by a crazy philosopher. Fortunately, you are next to the track and there happens to be a switch. You can flip the switch to lead the trolley down a different track to safety. But there is one person tied to that track. Should you flip the switch? You save 5, one dies. Do you act? Do you not act? These scenarios test us, our moral frameworks, and also I think they test our moral mettle. They lead us to consider whether there's a hierarchy in our moral demands. Does one demand outweigh or trump another? They lead us to ask whether maybe there's other factors involved other than just the commands or the demands, like relationships or consequences. What if the one person on the track is your son or your daughter? Does it change the situation? And importantly, of course, in a true dilemma, we are doomed to moral failure. Whichever way you go, you do something wrong. A version of this sort of problem that I hear Christians talk about a fair bit is this one. Imagine you are in Nazi Germany and you're hiding Jews in your basement. German soldiers come to your door and ask you whether you have any Jews in your house. If you tell the truth, they will most certainly die. What should you do? The question usually posed by this scenario is it ever okay to lie? The assumption that lying generally we know is wrong, but it's a test of whether in some circumstances is it okay. What should you do? Well, our preaching text today from Genesis 38 is perhaps not quite a moral dilemma like these hypotheticals, but it is a complex moral scenario. It tests some of our assumptions and intuitions with surprising results. And its outcome might even help shed some light on the famous Jews in the basement scenario. The moral complex is Tamar, and in the end, her course of action is said to be righteous. If you are visiting here today or you haven't been here for a few weeks, you heard Steve explain earlier that we're in a preaching series looking at the five women who are named in the genealogy of Jesus at the beginning of Matthew's Gospel. Tamar, Ruth, Bathsheba, Rahab, and Mary. Mary, Jesus' mother, and four women from the Old Testament. Women, of course, at that time were not ordinarily included in genealogies, and yet here in Matthew's Gospel we have five. The inclusion is not routine, and the inclusion is not accidental, so we can assume that the author intends us to understand something from it. The first and most obvious point is that this foreshadows the revolutionary way in which Jesus will reach out to and include women in his ministry with dignity, respect, and honour, and the way in which the gospel brings value, status, freedom, and equality for all people. But it does more than that too. And no, it is not just that they are all sinful. There's plenty of sinful men in Matthew's genealogy. He didn't need to include women to make that point, that sinful people are included. And in fact, I hope as we revisit their stories, we can move from some of our assumptions about their sinfulness. And no, it is not that they are all foreigners, though the inclusion of foreigners does become an important point. The presence of these women in the genealogy is not just to show us that women and foreigners and those on the margins can be accepted and included by God, although that is true. The presence of these women in the genealogy is to show us that women and foreigners and those on the margins are not just accepted or included as a concession, but they are examples of the kinds of people, the kinds of lives, and the kinds of actions that God desires for his disciples. In the face of the sin and the evil and the failures of the patriarchs, of God's people, of those at the centre, these women on the margins show us what righteousness, justice, and mercy really look like. They show us that righteousness doesn't always look how you think it might, and it might not be found where you expect it. So how does Tamar, the woman who pretends to be a prostitute in order to trick her father-in-law into sleeping with her so she can get pregnant, become a model of righteousness? It's a good question, a fair question. Judah is one of the 12 sons of Jacob. And in the previous chapter, after conspiring with his brothers, you might be more familiar with this story, to sell Joseph into slavery and to make their father believe that Joseph has died. After this act, Judah decides to move away from his family for a while He travels, he meets a woman, he gets married, and they have 3 sons. For his oldest son, Judah chooses a wife named Tamar. But Ur, we hear, is not a good man. Verse 7 says he was wicked in the Lord's sight and he dies. Now what happens next from verse 8 is because of something called the law of the Levier. We find it written about in Deuteronomy chapter 25, and it was this. When a married man died without a male heir, it was the duty of one of his relatives, usually his brother, to provide a child, a son, to the widow so that an heir would be produced. And the son that was produced would be the heir of the deceased man, the original husband, and would inherit his property. The point was that the dead man would have an heir and that the widow would have someone to provide for her. In a world where only men could inherit, this law was actually meant to protect young, childless widows from financial and social abandonment. So when Ur dies, this is what happens. Judah tells his second son, Onan, to provide the heir through Levirate marriage. But Onan doesn't want to give a child to Tamar. He knows that if he does, the child will not be his, and his own inheritance, now larger after the death of his brother, will be diluted. So Onan pretends to obey his father. He lives with Tamar as her husband. He uses her for his own sexual pleasure, but he, as the text says, spills his seed on the ground so that she can never get pregnant. God is not pleased with this blatant and intentional avoidance of his obligations, and it says Onan is also put to death. Now Judah has one son left, Shelah, and still he is too young to be married. But we hear Judah is not sure he wants to give his third and only remaining son to Tamar, because he's now feeling a little bit suspicious after the death of 2 sons. Instead of recognizing the evil of his own children, Judah assumes that Tamar must be the problem. Is she cursed? Is she killing his son? He's afraid that if he gives his third son in marriage, Shelah will die also. So on the pretense of waiting until Shelah is old enough, but actually we read, having no intention to follow through, he sends Tamar away and back to the home of her father to live as a widow, but technically betrothed to the third son in the family. And in doing so, Judah puts Tamar in the worst of all possible situations. Not truly a widow, technically engaged to Shelah, she's unable to remarry. With no husband or heir, she has no one to provide for her. And having married into a different clan, she is now really no longer at home in her father's household either, but dependent on their charity and mercy. If Judah had simply released her from the Levirate marriage duty, which he could have, she would have been free to remarry. But he doesn't. And yet he doesn't accept his proper responsibility. He keeps her bound to him. What he does, we must understand, is wrong. And Tamar, at this point, has now been abused and treated unfairly by no less than 3 men, 2 husbands and 1 father-in-law, and is now left to live out her days single and childless and in financial destitution. Time passes. Shelah, the third son, comes of age, and Judah's wife dies. After his period of mourning is over, Judah travels with his friends hereafter to visit the people who are shearing his sheep in a town nearby. Somehow Tamar catches wind of this, and suddenly the perspective of this story changes. So far we've seen only what happens to Tamar, and now we hear what she does. She sees an opportunity and she takes it. She changes out of her widow's clothes and she covers herself in a veil to disguise herself. Then she sits at the gates of a city named Enaim to wait for Judah to pass by. What does she intend to do? Most people assume she intends to act as a prostitute, to seduce Judah and try to fall pregnant. But in fact, we have no mention of prostitution in the text at all until Judah himself, assuming that she is one, asks her for sex. Perhaps she wanted to spy on Judah, to assess the situation before revealing herself. One writer suggests that she went to the city gates, actually, to plead her case before the elders, as Deuteronomy 25 makes provision for her to do. In any case, she sits by the entrance to Enaim and Judah passes by. He sees her. He does not recognize her as his daughter-in-law. He thinks she is a prostitute and he propositions her. The name of this city, Enaim, could mean twin wells. And there's a suggestion that this is a parody of a typical biblical betrothal scene. You've probably read some of those before. A boy meets a girl at a well and they fall in love, or as close to it as they did in those days. Instead of betrothal here, however, at the city of wells, we have something quite different. But the name also can mean eyes. And so the entrance to the city, the place where Tamar sits in the Hebrew, can be quite literally translated the opening of the eyes. Here, at the opening of the eyes, Tamar sits covered by a veil with only her eyes revealed. She sees at last that Judah never intended to give Shelah in marriage. Here, at the opening of the eyes, a man who has chosen not to see the need of his daughter-in-law for many years, once again does not see Tamar. Instead, he sees, or thinks he sees, a prostitute. He sees her, he knows her, and yet he does not see her at all. Here, at the opening of the eyes, Tamar is veiled, Judah is blind, and here begin the events that will lead to Judah's real eye-opening and recognition of his own wrongs. And here's where perhaps things get a little tricky. Whether she intends to seduce Judah or not, Tamar sees an opportunity and she takes it. She knows that she will never be married to Shelah. She believes her only chance for an heir now will be through Judah. So she plays along. They negotiate the price, but Judah doesn't have the goat. So Tamar asks for something as surety. What does she ask for? His signet, his cord, and his staff. His identifying items. It's like leaving, you know, your driver's license behind or your credit card at the bar. Markers of his identity and of his status. Tamar is daring and shrewd. She takes a risk, but she calculates it. And she goes back home to her father's house and waits. she's pregnant. Perhaps as it was read, you saw the comedy in the next scene, in Judah's efforts to send the goat to the prostitute. The man who won't fulfill his responsibilities to his daughter-in-law or to his dead son sends his friend traipsing all over the city, trailing a goat, trying to repay his debt to a prostitute. In verse 23, he's at pains to make it clear that he has tried to do the right thing. And then again, in the next scene, the comedy turns to tragedy as Judah hears of Tamar's condition. Your daughter-in-law Tamar is guilty of prostitution and as a result is now pregnant. The man who only moments ago tried to pay off a prostitute with a goat roars in rage, bring her out and burn her to death. He never cared much for her honour before, but now he cares passionately. And so the scene is set for the big reveal. And here Tamar's creative and risky and brilliant pursuit of justice is made known. As she was being brought out, she sent a message to her father-in-law. I am pregnant by the man who owns these. See if you recognize whose steel and cord and staff they are. And here in this moment, in these words of Tamar's vindication and Judah's confession, we have the same words as we heard only a chapter earlier in Genesis 37 that Judah and his own brothers had used in their deception of their father, of their brother Joseph's death, when they brought Joseph's bloodied robe. Do you recognize whose clothes these are? Tamar's deception and her use of these belongings reminds us of Judah's own act of deception. And yet the contrast couldn't be greater. And as Judah is forced to hear his own words and to remember his own past actions, he sees the difference between himself and Tamar. And his eyes are opened. Judah's next statement reveals that Tamar has done nothing wrong. In fact, she has done right. Judah has acted wrongly in refusing to give Shelah as her husband or to release Tamar. So Tamar has acted rightly in pursuing justice for herself, for her dead husband, and for the family line. She alone, of all the characters in the story, was willing to raise up offspring for her husband. Offspring whom we know eventually led all the way to Jesus. The book of Genesis is all about the fulfillment of God's promise to Abraham to give him many descendants. A promise that seems unlikely, seems impossible, and seems thwarted at every turn. Sarah is old and barren. Isaac's life is threatened. Rebecca is barren. Jacob usurps Esau. Jacob's wife Rachel seems to be unable to have children. The whole story up to this point that we hear is threat and progress towards the fulfillment of this promise. And many times, in the stories, it is the Lord's miraculous hand that moves events forward. In Tamar's story, the promise of descendants is also threatened. Not because of her, but because of Judah's sin. And in this story, God doesn't need to intervene because Tamar acts for him. In righteousness and faith, she works for justice and fulfills God's plan. So going back to our moral dilemmas, does this story test some of your moral intuitions? Judah is definitely in the wrong, that's pretty clear. But is Tamar right? Should she just suffer in silence, get old and starve and accept what's happened to her? Looked at a certain way, it's hard to see. Can it be okay to pretend to be a prostitute to trick someone into getting you pregnant? It's not a question I want my daughter to consider for long. Is she, like in a moral dilemma, doomed to moral failure no matter what she does? Or can her actions truly be righteous? Well, her actions are called righteous, and Judah acknowledges it. In fact, I think she's one of only two people in the Old Testament who are called righteous, Abraham and Tamar. The passage helps us see that righteousness is not devoid of context or relationships, but to be righteous is to behave in a way that is appropriate to others and to fulfill the requirements and obligations of your relationships. Tamar's story shows that righteousness is not a virtue that an individual possesses in independence from others, nor is it primarily about meeting laws or rules or standards. It is something one practices in relationship with others. And in the Jewish context, it's closely linked to the concept of justice. The task of righteousness is to render justice and the claims which it implies. So Tamar's action both rendered the justice due to her and her deceased husband, and it affected the good of all of Judah's clan. Her story critiques Judah's actions, which sanctions her oppression for the sake of his self-serving prudence. Judah's words contrast the two characters, one who promised to do right and one who did right. What does it do to our Jews in the basement dilemma, if I can call it that, if we think of righteousness as about fulfilling the obligations of our relationships? Tamar is included in the genealogy of Matthew to introduce this theme of righteousness, to introduce the person of righteousness who is to come, to introduce Jesus. Jesus is presented in Matthew as the one who teaches and embodies a new righteousness. Tamar points toward the Messiah who will in himself fulfill all righteousness, and in doing so, will radically redefine what it is to lead a righteous life. As a righteous Messiah, he will bring justice to all those on the margins of society who are mistreated, disenfranchised, including a number of women. As a teacher, he will oppose the hypocrisy of the Pharisees who neglected true justice for the sake of propriety and self-preservation. And in his teaching, he will reveal that the demands of righteousness, of relational, ethical righteousness, are greater, not less, than rule-keeping. Not a list of don'ts, but a command to love. And he will reveal that righteousness is often seen in unlikely places. So today we celebrate Tamar, not as we might often think of the biblical women, not as a sinner forgiven, but as a woman of strength, courage, ingenuity, justice, and righteousness.